Good day, everyone, and welcome to today's program. At this time, all participants are in a listen-only mode. Later, you will have the opportunity to ask questions during the Q&A session. Please note this call may be recorded. It is now my pleasure to turn the call over to Mr. Ray Offenhauser. Please go ahead, sir.
Thank you very much. First, I'd like to just thank the journalists that are on the line, as well as our call participants who will be speaking in turn. And maybe just briefly to introduce them, Mark Tirsic is with us, who is the president of The Nature Conservancy, along with Jim Wallace, the president of Sojourners, and Brigadier General Stephen A. Cheney, United States Marine Corps retired, who's a board member of the American Security Project, who will all be speaking on the issue of international climate finance from a variety of different perspectives. What I'd like to do is just offer a couple of minutes of just opening remarks to kind of frame the issue as we see it. And obviously, as a representative of Oxfam, I'm speaking from the perspective of a development organization. As we all know, last week, Senator Kerry and Senator Lieberman introduced the long-awaited American Power Act, which is obviously moving the debate on climate change forward. And we very much, obviously, all of us appreciate the tenacity that Senators Kerry and Lieberman are showing and maintaining and providing this forward movement on this very urgent issue and on the legislation itself. But I think from our point of view, unfortunately, the bill is not going far enough. It's not really going the distance for communities and natural resources who are on the front lines of climate change around the world and dealing with the impacts of climate change day to day. And in our view, in order to mobilize the global climate action that's needed to solve the climate crisis here at home, the senators must invest more in the whole question of international adaptation, international finance, than has been done so far and has been represented in the bill. As the debate's continuing, the lack of adequate and immediate investments in international action to tackle climate change, in our view, really needs to be urgently addressed. And that's really why we've convened this call today and what we're, you know, really urging as a group. And maybe just some overview on how we see the issue of international finance and from a development perspective. Around the world presently, climate change is already, in our view, taking its toll on poor and vulnerable communities. And as Oxfam, we see that every day. And it's also our view that it's likely to get worse as time goes forward. We estimate that the number of people likely to be affected by climate-related disasters each year will increase by 50% by 2015, affecting the lives of some 375 million people. And that's, as is obvious probably to all of us, more than the entire population of the United States. So given the scale of that need and the funding for adaptation programs in this bill is, you know, extraordinarily inadequate. And to make things even worse, it's not set to begin disbursements until 2019. Communities, in effect, need to be proactive in providing solutions to the problems they're facing today, not, you know, some 10 years from now. And taking action to increase the resilience of vulnerable communities is not just the right thing to do, it's really the smart thing to do. Responses to climate impacts can yield enormous benefits on four very important fronts: reducing vulnerability in these communities, enhancing global security, showing U.S. leadership to the rest of the world, and strengthening our national economy. And maybe briefly on each of these points. On the security question, climate change undermines global security by creating economic instability, conflict over natural resources, and migration pressures. By investing in the resilience and adaptation of vulnerable communities to the effects of climate change or the impacts of climate change, we obviously can proactively build a more secure future and avoid costly conflicts. On the question of reducing vulnerability, preparing for climate impacts in critical sectors such as water and agriculture and natural resource management can have huge payoffs when the next weather shock occurs. Helping local communities to protect and manage natural ecosystems through the planting of mangrove trees to ward off erosion along coastlines are all proven adaptation strategies that are well within our reach. They're doable, and we've done them in a variety of places around the world. On the question of U.S. leadership, investments in adaptation are vital to reaching a global climate agreement. This has been clear since Bali. Such investments would obviously showcase American leadership on the international stage and help us deliver global action. And finally, on economic opportunity, Investments in adaptation also provide U.S. businesses and workers with new incentives to provide innovative climate adaptation services and technologies, building stronger, more resilient water and agricultural systems in vulnerable communities. Adaptation investments also help to protect the supply chains of many major American businesses. We know this from conversations with many of the sort of commodity export firms, from those that are dealing with coffee to those that are importing cotton from countries across Africa for apparel production. So from mangroves that stop coastal erosion and protect coastlines from storms to early warning systems that alert communities when storms come, supporting adaptation is crucial and beneficial today. Our hope is that Senator Reid will push forward on a strong, comprehensive climate package that will address our global climate challenge and that will include international climate resilience as a centerpiece of what's in that bill. For his part, President Obama can and hopefully will add his weight to this effort. He was in Copenhagen, he knows the issues, and he recognizes what's at stake. So with that, in a broad overview and framing, what I'd like to do now is maybe turn to Mark Tirsic, who is the president and CEO of the Nature Conservancy, a major environmental organization that's been very active on the international finance question, and have Mark ask Mark to provide a perspective from the environmental community.
Okay, thank you very much, Ray. Thank you to all the reporters for checking in. We really appreciate your interest in this important topic. I only have a little bit more to say to add to Ray. I mean, Ray said it very well. But the first point I'd like to make is I'm really pleased to be here with the other speakers because I'd like to emphasize these are not just environmental issues we're talking about. There are many dimensions to this, poverty and economic development, security, and moral issues. And our various each of the speakers, therefore, have a role to play here. But I'm glad we're here as a group because I think that's the right way to frame the issue. And let me just say that this is something Americans should really care about. As climate change happens, and it's happening, you know, we're a science-based conservation organization. Skeptics can debate the rate of change in the future if they'd like, but climate change is happening as we speak, and it's going to impact Americans. Americans will feel that impacts very directly, from threats to national security to refugee issues to increased cost on imported goods, et cetera. So Americans have a stake in all that, but of course, the really vulnerable folks are the vulnerable people in developing countries who really lie in harm's way. Ray just talked about that. And we believe Americans care about that too. Americans want to do the right thing. Now let me speak from the perspective of the Nature Conservancy for a minute about the environmental view here. And again, we're a science-based organization, so we really mean what we say. Tackling climate change is just not about lowering emissions of greenhouse gases. It's also helping people and nature prepare for the inevitable impact of climate change that's coming. And Ray talked about this, but it's important for everybody to understand that the services that nature provides people are pretty darn important. They include food, clean water, shelter, income, et cetera. And so why are we concerned about the prospect of climate change right this minute? Well, fresh water resources, just one example, very vulnerable. And obviously, fresh water is key for drinking water, for agricultural purposes, et cetera, kind of a no-brainer. Likewise, and regrettably, we see this more and more of the world's population lives near coasts, and coasts are now extraordinarily dangerous due to severe storms. Well, nature can provide great buffer to those storms. So we believe very strongly that smart investments today in ecosystems can really help vulnerable people and really people kind in general best deal with inevitable climate change. Ray mentioned some of this, but mangroves, healthy mangroves can protect against storm surges. Healthy forests can reduce landslides and also provide clean water, forest products, and carbon sequestration. Healthy wetlands serve as buffers against floods. Coral reefs support fisheries and provide food security. Healthy natural areas generate income from tourism, ecotourism, et cetera. And we've seen counterexamples of each of these things, so it's really not that controversial. Now, we salute Senators Kerry and Lieberman for championing the American Power Act, and in many respects, we think it's a great bill, and we're really excited to finally see some progress, and we hope the White House will strongly support it. But exactly as Ray said, funding for international adaptation is woefully insufficient. Ray walked you through the numbers. And we think it's very important that be addressed now. And we urge journalists on this call to pay attention to this important topic. Thanks very much.
Thanks so much, Mark. And now I'd like to turn to Reverend Jim Wallace, president of Sojourners, an organization that's been on the front lines of leading the faith community in work on poverty issues and that has embraced the whole issue of climate change and climate change finance. Jim, I'll turn it to you.
Thank you, Ray. And I think Mark said it well. This is no longer just an environmental issue or a political issue. It's a moral issue, but I would contend it's a religious issue too. Because the scriptures call us to be good stewards of God's creation, as well as to care for the poor and vulnerable. Well, they come together right here. One of the greatest threats facing the poorest populations worldwide is climate change. So climate change represents a triple injustice against the poor. First, they contribute to its causes the least. Second, they are most affected by its consequences. And third, they're least able to respond and adapt to the changes and the disasters it brings to their lives. So responding to this injustice, really, you might say also, it's a sanctity of life issue and certainly an issue for us of moral responsibility. This is now a mainstream and passionate issue in all of our churches, evangelical, Catholic, mainline, African-American, Hispanic, Asian-American. It's an interfaith issue as well across all of our boundaries. So we're saying Congress must not only take action within U.S. borders here, but provide the support to help international communities overcome the threats of our climate change and climate here. Ray said it well, from natural disasters to food and water security, increase in violence and competition over resources, and maybe 200 million climate refugees by 2050, the increased rates of disease. This is really a disaster here. And so we have to provide poor populations the means to adapt to climate change now, and that will stave off many of the consequences of these changes. And so, this bill, while I applaud its maybe a signal, signaling the start of an effort here, to be prophetic in a religious sense, I guess I have to say, when it comes to adaptation, this bill is pathetic. It's really pathetic. It just doesn't begin to respond to the fundamental issues of fairness and justice. And so it's time for us to stop contributing most to this problem and then impacting those who contribute least and taking no responsibility for our behavior. So the faith community is really strongly committed to not just to this bill, but to improving the bill so that adaptation is much more central. It's only fair. It's only right. It's a moral, it's a religious issue for us. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Jim. And now I'd like to turn to retired Brigadier General Stephen A. Chesney, a board member of the American Security Project and a member of a group that's been looking at the climate change issue from a security vantage point. General Chesney?
Thanks, Ray. Let me just correct for a second. My name is Steve Chaney.
Chaney, pardon me.
I'm not related to Dick at all, but I did work for him at one time. I come at this issue from perhaps a different perspective than all of you, and in my presence on the board of the American Security Project kind of outlines this. They have published a report called the Climate Security Index, which talks about all the changes that you all addressed and where they are taking place in the world and the effect on our national security. I view it as two primary threats. Climate change is a big one, and then our dangerous dependence on foreign energy, particularly oil. When you look at how that's affecting our daily lives, it's going to impact our national security for years and years to come. The Department of Defense has recognized this. It was written into their last quadrennial defense review. It's been in the forefront of both the last two administrations. The intelligence community has also recognized it as a threat. And I, for one, am pleased that now it's finally coming to a point of legislation and something's getting through Congress. Jim, I understand your comments about the inadequacy of the legislation, and we recognize that. We would love it to be much stronger and much better, but I guess I come up from the point of it's at least we have something and we're getting started somewhere, because we better start now. We cannot wait. When you look at our dependence on foreign oil, we're actually funneling money to our enemies. I mean, the oil that comes from places like Venezuela, Iran, and other countries, a lot of that money gets funded to them, and it gets funneled right through back to terrorists. And our troops that are in Iraq and Afghanistan are facing those terrorists that are funded by a lot of that oil money. We need to get off this dependence on oil, period, not just foreign oil, with alternative energy sources. When you look around the world and all the threats that we have to national security, you can quickly understand that in most cases, a lot of times, the first tool in the toolbox of foreign policy that the president picks up is his national security apparatus, normally the military. So they're the ones who get impacted immediately, and in many cases, it's their lives that they're paying for this threat that we have to our country. Throughout the world, you can see, pick all the hot spots that many of you have already outlined. I'll give you but a couple of examples. Look at Somalia. Drought, they've got terrible problems. There are terrorists, and now, of course, it's been a haven for piracy that's affecting the shipping lanes that are off of Africa. North Africa, East Africa, Middle East, South Asia, these are all having devastating effects from droughts, lower agricultural yields, and less fresh water. And this will feed another of issues that are going to impact our national security. Some might think that immigration is not going to be affected, but it's going to. Climate change possesses a real significant risk to Mexico. As you know, there's some instability down there, and I live in deep South Texas, so I'm very close to it. If you think we have an illegal immigration problem now, climate change is just going to exacerbate this and make it much, much worse. You know, the truth is, if we ignore the warnings of the scientists and national security leaders, we're just going to deepen our addiction to imported oil and hamstring the economy and weaken the country. But if we do what we need to do, and I support the legislation, but I would like it to be much, much stronger, and we do it sooner rather than later, the United States can lead the world in a new wave of profitable green technology and will reduce our dependence on foreign energy supplies and reduce our contribution to global warming. So I think the choice is clear. We've got to act now. At least we have a start here, but of course we'd like it to be much stronger. And I thank all the reporters for being on the line.
Thank you very much, General Cheney. And now we'd like to turn to the reporters and open the line to take some questions, and the operator will provide, I guess, necessary instructions to enable us to do that.
Absolutely. And at this time, if you would like to register to ask a question, please press the star and 1 on your touch-tone phone. Once again, to ask a question, please press the star and 1 keys now. Keep in mind that you may remove yourself from the question queue at any time by pressing the pound key. And we'll pause for a moment now to allow questions the opportunity to queue. And it looks like we will take a question now from the line of Alan Greenblatt with NPR. Please go ahead.
Hello. I wanted to ask a question, I guess, just putting the adaptation issue in context of the climate change debate. I have to admit, this is an issue I dip into and out of, so maybe this is naive, but my sense is that 4 or 5 years ago, adaptation in addressing the effects of climate change was a controversial issue within the environmental community. There seemed to be a sense that the need to mitigate climate change by reducing emissions was more of a priority in the idea of trying to adapt. Was seen as almost kind of a surrender, but my sense is that in the last few years, there's been a sense that, as you said, that climate change is happening and that adaptation is necessary. So I just wonder if you can speak to how adaptation has risen as a priority and how much you're able to get people to focus on that issue as they address the other question of trying to reduce emissions.
Well, this is Ray. Maybe I'll make an opener and then turn to Mark. I mean, I think for those of us in the development community, the issue of the need for adaptation and thinking about adaptation is very real, because we see the impacts in sub-Saharan Africa of reduced drought cycles, and in southern Africa, increasing rain that upset sort of the agricultural productivity in those regions. And we see glacier melt in the high Andes affecting downstream agricultural systems. So for us, this, from a development point of view, this has become a very real issue. And I think what's what's occurred over the last, say, 5-6 years is a coming together between development groups, conservation groups like Mark's, and the broader environmental community to realize we've got to address both the mitigation and adaptation questions. And so now more and more frequently you'll see Mark and I and many other colleagues at the same table talking about these issues as part of a common agenda. Mark, maybe you want to address it from the conservation and the environment perspective.
Yep, happy to do that, Ray, and I agree with Ray. There is no question from our perspective at the Nature Conservancy, it's critical we address adaptation right now, and that's because climate change is occurring right now. And so it's an enormously high priority for us, and I don't think it's any longer controversial across environmental institutions. Now, mitigation is also important. So, you know, life is complicated. We have to pursue both at once. But adaptation is enormously important. And really, that's what's behind this call. That's the aspect of the bill that's been introduced where we're most disappointed. The bill is more focused on mitigation, also important. But from our perspective as environmentalists, but we also echo Ray's perspective from the vulnerable people perspective, it's critical that the funds be invested in adaptation right now.
Well, I mean, do you feel you are still, you've all agreed among yourselves, but are you say that the bill doesn't reflect this consensus. I mean, how much of a struggle is it to get policymakers to focus on this issue?
I would say it's a struggle. We have a lot of work to do. There's another aspect of the bill that we haven't talked about today that we think is lacking from the Nature Conservancy's perspective, and that's investments in tropical forests. Tropical rainforests are enormously attractive ways to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. By saving them, it's one of the lowest cost and lowest tech best ways to reduce the greenhouse gases, and it has enormous co-benefits. It has adaptation benefits. It has benefits for the vulnerable people who live in forests. It, of course, has important biodiversity conservation benefits. But both forests and adaptation, we're struggling to get the attention that those issues deserve in our judgment on the Hill. When we talk at the Conservancy, when we talk to our members across the country, and we have a million members in all 50 states, red states, blue states, Republicans, Democrats, you name it. When we talk about these issues, our members get it, and they tell us they strongly support it. For some reason, we're not as effective as we should be in transmitting that message to the Hill, and that's one of the reasons we're so eager to talk to you journalists about it.
Yeah, I would agree. I mean, I think one of the things we've made, I think it's probably fair to say, a lot of progress in terms of imprinting the issue of adaptation on the congressional leadership and on membership across the parties. And there is a constituency for it on the Hill, but it's not strong enough. And we are you know, living in these hard economic times, and we are debating issues of, you know, national deficit and so forth, so that these, you know, there is a kind of an offset here when you're sort of looking at, well, you know, how are we going to address these mitigation challenges at home while at the same time adequately addressing the adaptation challenges overseas. I think one of the critical issues here for us is there's a pay now or pay later problem, you know, at stake here. And I think that's part of what we're saying as a collective, that, you know, to some degree avoiding this issue complicates, you know, our getting to yes in terms of negotiations. It complicates potentially our security frame globally because of, it may ultimately start precipitating the kind of migration scenarios, the, you know, kind of climate-related migration scenarios that the general described, and precipitating the collapse of agricultural systems, you know, fragile agricultural systems in various parts of the world. That will affect, you know, global food security. So this is, you know, and in the end of the day, we'll end up responding to those, and it'll probably cost us more money later than it may cost us today if we figure out prudent ways of securing that financing and prudent ways of investing it and expending it on adaptation and resilience strategies.
I'd like to speak to that, too. I mean, Ray said it well. I was in a meeting with a number of senators recently on the Hill who are pushing this legislation, and when the faith community raised the issue of adaptations as a moral issue, they all agreed, and you could tell they were kind of gulping around the room and saying, yes, that's true. But the political reality is there are constituencies that are powerful in the Senate to speak on behalf of adaptations. The coal states make sure coal interests are represented, nuclear industry is where I represented. But, you know, who's speaking up for the poorest around the world? They don't have lobbyists on K Street. So on the one hand, this is a moral issue, and the faith community is taking up the challenge, saying we have to speak for those who have no voice. That's our job. But Ray's right. This is an issue of interdependence. And to not see how failing to respond right now will impact us later on is to be terribly short-sighted. So if we only look at constituencies in the short term and not how our interdependence in the long term, what is a disaster for poor people around the world will also eventually become a disaster for us as well. So it's moral, but it's also practical. And so we're asking for a longer vision, a longer range view, and not just the short-term constituency mindset that always plagues Capitol Hill. So let's take a longer view and a moral view and recognize that there are no walls that protect us anymore. We are interdependent with the poorest people around the world now.
Shall we turn to another question?
We will take our next question from the line of Sean Tandon with AFP. Please go ahead.
Hi, this is Sean Tandon with AFP. Thanks for doing this call. I just wanted to ask just to see how this relates to other pledges made by the U.S. and by other countries. In Copenhagen, Hillary Clinton was there and saying that the U.S. would contribute to, I believe the figure was $100 billion by 2020, not just the U.S., but other countries involved in that. In terms of, I mean, could there be the potential, even if there isn't adaptation funding in the current legislation, could there still be scope for U.S. support for adaptation, you know, through other legislation, through other, you know, at other budget times in Congress? And just on that note, I mean, just reading through, you know, obviously it's a very long text, but reading through the American Power Act, as far as I understand it, I mean, there's no, there's really no exact figure at all. No, I mean, it's very, very vague in terms of what would actually be given for adaptation. I just want to know if that's how you understood it. That's just a very general promise to support adaptation funding overseas.
Well, I mean, I think the figure that we have calculated now, or the rough estimate, is that for adaptation right now is basically about $700 million a year with funding, with actually disbursements starting in 2020. And it could be actually less than that. There's some economic modeling that's being done currently on the bill that's on the floor, and we won't really have the results of that until early June. But we don't actually see it breaking a billion based on the sort of the math that's before us at the moment. And we won't really have, you know, more solid numbers and analysis until, you know, till early June. So I mean, that's, you know, in a world in which, you know, some of the estimates are that, you know, that we needed $50 billion annually, and we're under $1 billion. I mean, obviously, the math there it leaves quite a bit of a gap. In terms of other sourcing and other views on the legislation, I don't know whether, Mark, do you want to address that? Are there some perspectives you have on the financing questions? Did we lose Mark? I think we may have lost Mark, who had to leave to another meeting. I mean, I think the other thing I would say on that is that I think those of us who are kind of looking at this are obviously pushing for, you know, to get some real results with the legislation that we've got before us now. But I think we're also looking at other questions of, you know, are there, you know, other creative ways of imposing certain kinds of tax levies on all kinds of different sorts of transactions that might actually generate revenue from other sources. On airline and marine transport and on a variety of different things, because I think, you know, I think when you're speaking about the kinds of commitments the administration is making on climate adaptation or on food security and on other around another a whole range of different issues, you know, in support of their broader development agenda, as well as the climate change and adaptation agenda, you know, we've got to begin to get creative about where that money is going to come from, and I think the optimal outcome would be situations where we can actually secure revenue streams that are going to meet the needs that have been identified and been the product of rigorous analysis, while at the same time maybe also changing behaviors. In other words, moving us toward a greener economy or moving us toward uses of different technologies that lower the emissions levels. And I'm not sure we've gotten to the point where we've actually sort of linked the discussions about the financing mechanisms that maybe the alternatives be, you know, beyond the bill with, these questions of broader societal behavioral change. That's a bigger discussion, but, you know, I think it's probably certainly coming down the line when, you know, as we look at the sort of the tough economic picture that we're faced with.
Thanks.
I don't know whether anybody else wanted to comment on that, whether Jim or General Cheney might want to say anything about that.
No, I think you've hit it well.
Yeah, I agree.
Okay. Further questions?
As a reminder, if you would like to ask a question, please press the star and one on your touch-tone phone. And we'll pause another moment to allow any additional questions the opportunity to queue.
While we're doing that, I just Steve Cheney here. I'd just like to make a quick comment about the American Security Project. That we are, it is not a lobbying organization. So in terms of going up on the Hill and saying they support or do not support legislation, they don't do that. It's public policy and research. Although my personal opinion is, of course, that I support the legislation and I think it could be much, much stronger.
And just as another reminder, that's star and one to ask a question. And it does appear that we have no further questions at this time.
Very good. Well, maybe just and by way of closing remarks, I might just say again, I think what we've seen demonstrated in the call is I think Mark pointed out that this is not an issue that is isolated to a particular interest group, be they environmentalists or developmentalists or what have you. This is an issue that's bringing together faith-based groups, development groups, environmental and conservation groups, the security community, and so forth. And all of us, I think, together realize the importance of investing not only in addressing the core mitigation challenge that we as major emitters face here in the United States and certainly must be addressed, but also in the interest of fairness and justice and in our national security in the long term. It's going to be important that collectively we push for adequate levels of international finance in the legislation that will be passed in the House and the Senate. And we will continue to be invested in that effort, and we'll continue collectively to be pushing for that, both in the public media as well as in our interactions with legislators and executive branch representatives. And we look forward to any other opportunities to interact with those of you that have been kind enough to join us today from the media. So thank you all very much. And with that, we will terminate the call. Thank you all very, very much.
Thank you.
Thanks, Jim and General Cheney, very, very much for joining us.
You're welcome.
And once again, this will conclude today's teleconference. Thank you again for your participation. You may disconnect your lines, and please enjoy the rest of your day.
Thank you very much.